If cinephiles know the name of one designer of film titles or film posters, it's Saul Bass. For most of the last half of the 20th century, Saul Bass succeeded at bringing a unique avant-garde approach to film promotion and filmmaking in Hollywood, and a new book explores the incredible journey of Saul Bass through his designs and films. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Today we discuss the work and life of Saul Bass with Jan Christopher Horak, director of the UCLA Film and Television Archive and author of the book Saul Bass, Anatomy of Film Design. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Charles.
I should note that we are no relation that we know of.
No, not at all.
I've awaited this book for some time, ever since I heard you were working on it. I'm a huge Saul Bass fan, and I gather this is really the first time that I know of that someone has written so exhaustively about the man and his designs.
Well, it's the daughter, Jennifer Bass, and Pat Kirkham put out a big coffee cake table book, which is kind of reviews his career and has a lot of images and stuff like
Beautifully illustrated.
Beautifully illustrated, and is a great piece of documentation, but I'm the first author to really look at his work critically and try to pull back the curtain and see how he came up with his ideas and developed his aesthetic and brand.
If listeners don't know the name Saul Bass, they no doubt will have a mental image of his work, I think, when we list some of his designs. What do you rank as some of his most indelible film industry work?
Certainly his titles, the titles, which is where you get the credits at the beginning of the film, for films like Hitchcock's Vertigo, with the spiral, and then the Psycho is a famous title, his titles for Man with the Golden Arm, for Advice and Consent, for The Cardinal, and then finally near the end of his career, he did a whole bunch of really interesting titles for Marty Scorsese, including Cape Fear, Goodfellas, The Age of Innocence, and Casino.
And two of my favorites are also Kubrick's Spartacus and Hitchcock's North by Northwest.
And actually, probably a lot of listeners will know Saul Bass not from his film work, but from his logo work.
Yes.
I mean, he designed things like the United Airlines logo, the Girl Scouts of America logo, the AT&T logo, and those are things that, of course, are really a part of the general culture, and people will instantly recognize.
This was a man that began in advertising in New York, and at some point, I guess, working for ad firms, began to do some print advertising for studios back in L.A., How did he segue into becoming one of the most prominent, or at least identifiable in the 1950s, designers of both film posters and title sequences?
Well, he started out of high school working for ad agencies in New York, and specifically, but transitioned pretty quickly as of maybe 1939, to working for agencies that catered to film companies. And if you remember, at that time, Warner Brothers, Lowe's Incorporated, Paramount, they all had their offices in New York, not in Los Angeles. And that's where, the distribution companies were. That's where they actually organized all the publicity campaigns, et cetera. L.A. was really only a site for production. So he was there and working, basically learning the craft of how to put together advertising, and he was a so-called cut-and-paste guy. He was the one that took the lettering and the images and then, cut them up and then pasted them back together on a board, so that's how they would create the advertisements, which then went into, the newspapers, magazines, and other print media.
One of the things I love about your book is you really set the context, particularly in the 1950s, of the rest of the world, what it looked like. If people aren't familiar with Saul Bass's work, it was very minimalist, very influenced by German and European design aesthetics from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And these designs were coming out at a time when Hollywood's still using illustrations of large headshots of the stars and with some taglines, and just striking how different his work was compared to the rest of what Hollywood was doing and producing.
Well, he had gone to Hollywood in 1946 as an art director for an advertising agency, and just before that, he had attended a course with George Kepes, who was a Hungarian designer, but who had studied in Berlin at the Bauhaus under Laszlo Hojnagy, and published a very influential book in 1944 called Vision in Motion, and was teaching at Brooklyn College. And it seems that Bass actually attended his class, at least for a semester, because Kepes then went up to Chicago. But that really influenced him. The advertising up until that point, and posters too, they wanted to get all messages to all people into one design. And so they would just cram the ads and the posters full of information, mm-hmm. you know, with all the headshots of the stars and quotes and et cetera. It was just a huge jumble. And Bass, being influenced by the Bauhaus, which was looking at trying to clean up design to make messages much more targeted, and also look at all advertising and this publicity as a form of art, too. So he radically eliminates a lot of that, begins using kind of logo-like symbols to advertise films, and then just only a minimum amount of text so that people would remember that. So his first campaign for Otto Preminger that really had a huge impact was The Man with the Golden Arm, which had this kind of crooked arm reaching down, and that logo was actually used in the theaters on the marquees with nothing else, because they'd done a like 6-week campaign, Man with the Golden Arm, with this arm as the most prominent aspect of that advertising. So that when the film opened in New York, they only put the arm on the marquee, nothing else, and that was enough to sell the film. So that kind of advertising was what Bass specialized in, and it was really a kind of advertising that made sense for the times, because in the 1950s, the American studio system is starting to break down. Mm-hmm. After 1948, you have the Paramount Consent Decree, which has said that film companies could no longer block book. They could no longer sell, like, to a theater owner 10 films at a time and say, you got to take all of them if you want Gone with the Wind. You have to take these 9 other garbage films, right? That broke down because the studios no longer owned the theaters and the distribution companies. So they had to sell their films on an individual basis. And so you get producer-directors who already have declared their independence, who really have to sell each film individually. And this was a much better way to do that than to have, you know, all this stuff that was mostly advertising the studio.
I'm glad you mentioned Otto Preminger and the early work that Saul Bass did on his films, because Preminger became a real champion. And reading the book, you know, it seemed clear to me, at least in the 50s, that without characters like Otto Preminger, who is one of those great early producer-director hyphenates and a fairly independently leaning maker, Billy Wilder, Hitchcock, who was British but had worked early on in Germany. Preminger was born in Austria-Hungary. Wilder was a German emigre. These directors were championing his work and making sure he was on their projects. And I gather it's their own early influences that led them to him.
Well, I think that's very true. That somebody, you know, they all, of course, lived in Germany in the 1920s, so they knew of the work of the Bauhaus, and they considered that modern, and they wanted their films to be perceived as modern, So they wanted their advertising also to be modern. That's why they gravitated to someone like Saul Bass. And Saul Bass, of course, by the mid-1950s, has positioned himself as not, you know, a studio advertising guy, but a high-end graphic designer who claims he never worked in the industry, that he was a graphic designer who goes into film then, already at the high end. And I think there's definitely that sympathy. But there were others, too, who, people like Edward Lewis, you know, who was the producer of Spartacus, more East Coast intellectual types, but all of them, again, mostly working independently from the studios. And Bass never had that much luck with the studios. When he did Stanley Kramer is another one who, you know, he worked quite a bit for. But, for example, when he did the advertising and the credit sequences for Pride and the Passion, this big costume epic that Kramer did, there was a lot of interference from the studios because the studio people said, well, Bass is too independent and he's too expensive and, you know, they'd rather just use somebody else.
Reading the book, he's one of those figures that seems in alignment with a lot of the great auteurs and directors of the 40s and 50s, the Hollywood Golden Age, that were not comfortable talking about what they did in terms of art. You frequently refer to interviews he'd given where he talks about craft, that he tended to push back when people are trying to apply meaning or philosophies to his work. Is that because he truly didn't see himself as an artist, or because of the time period he was working in, he knew that was a loaded term that, at least corporately or in Hollywood, could cause him some trouble?
Well, I think it was a little of both. I think he was always modest in that regard, and I think secretly he wanted to be an artist, but to claim to be an artist is something else again. If you're in a medium like design, which at that time did not have a very good reputation, it was really considered, you know, commercial work and certainly not artistic. But he does bring art and aesthetics to it, and of course the filmmakers he's working with, as you correctly point out, were auteurs, and That makes sense. On the other hand, yes, he liked, even though I'm positive that he read art theory, especially Moholy-Nagy and George Kepes, he never wanted to talk, because, of course, in Hollywood, to do that makes you an intellectual, and that's the kiss of death.
Yes.
And, of course, in the 1950s, this country was still also quite anti-intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
So that you were considered an egghead if you even thought about stuff or you brought up theory or anything like that. So he really wanted to stay away from that. So he would always claim, well, you know, this is all just intuition of the artist, you know, to figure out how to do this stuff. But given the incredible consistency of his work and the way, you know, over decades, he develops a brand that is so instantaneously recognizable that modern designers today, you know, working in the digital age, often like to quote him or pay homage to him by doing titles that look like Saul Bass, and everybody knows this is an homage to Saul Bass.
That branding of himself and his design, one of the things you do in the book is also dispel sort of the cult that has built up around him. He was a very effective manager of talent as well, and as much as his work was maybe in contrast to the traditional Hollywood studio system, he himself operated an office that was very studio-like in that he had very talented designers and artists working for him that he would put his own stamp on and take credit for. He would shape those ideas, but the execution of them was often left to a very talented stable of people in his departments there.
Yeah, I mean, at the high point of his career, he was employing something like 30 to 40 people in his design office. So it really, and they were doing all kinds of, they were doing film work, they were doing, of course, the corporate logo work. A lot of energy was involved in that whole corporate identity campaigns that involved everything from not just the logo, but to the uniforms, to, you know, the way the trucks looked, everything. Everything had or was designed. He did gas stations, stuff like that. I mean, what I say in the introduction of my book, I think is an important point, is that, you know, while Hollywood, as the 50s wore on and the whole system transitioned to one of independent freelance workers, everyone needed a film credit. So there is a real emphasis on that. But Bass did run his office like a traditional design office. And the way designers work, this is the way designers work. The head designer, the owner of the office, he gets the credit even though lots of other people work for them. I mean, my mother-in-law was a designer in Chicago, interior designer in Chicago, quite successful. And she had lots of people working in her office, but it was her name that went on things. And that was what brought the clients in.
Saul Bass's marketing and poster work led to title sequence work, which we've mentioned, and even more experimental film work. He made some short films. He won an Academy Award for one of those, Why Man Creates, in the 60s, and made one feature film in 1974, Phase 4. All of that film work that developed out of that, I think one of the controversies from that period is his participation with Alfred Hitchcock in the making of Psycho. This went beyond the normal title sequence in that Hitchcock had asked him to develop storyboards in the sequence for the very famous shower scene with Janet Leigh. And I gather that's still a bit up in the air over how much of that shower sequence is Saul Bass versus Alfred Hitchcock.
Right. You know, there are a number of authors who have been commenting on this, and it was a controversy. But it's interesting because, as I've kind of figured out, Saul Bass doesn't say a word about Psycho until 1974.
Hmm.
And it's in 74, at the very moment they're about to release his own first fiction feature film, Phase 4, that he says to a British journalist, directed the shower sequence. Now, a couple of years earlier already, François Truffaut, in his famous interview, and Eric Rohmer, in their famous interview with Hitchcock, had actually asked Hitchcock about Saul Bass's involvement in the direction of Psycho in a couple of sequences, and especially the shower sequence. And Hitchcock had kind of poo-pawed them and said, you know, he did some storyboards, but I let him direct one scene, the scene where Abergas is going up the stairs and then it gets pushed back down. But he messed it up, so that was the end of that. And, of course, that was not very nice of him to say that, but it was typical Hitchcock. So maybe Bass was just taking his revenge, but frankly, I don't think the controversy is ever going to be solved, because almost all of the evidence that there's no real documentary evidence in terms of paper records or anything like that, and so you have only eyewitness accounts, but most of those were recorded 30, 40 years later, and of course people's memories change. But what I can say is, I mean, I'm quite sure that Bass did do the storyboards. He also designed a few other things, like the perspective of the way the house on the hill is situated in relationship to the Bates Motel down below, and several other things. But there are, first of all, Hitchcock was never known as a montage specialist, but Bass was. Bass had, and most people don't know this, had been cutting commercials for television for a number of years already and was getting a reputation as a montage specialist. That's the first thing. And the second is there are shots in the film, in that sequence, which are just pure Bass, including, for
yes,
example, the last shot of the drain. That drain,
yes,
was and the kind of weird angle of the drain matches a shot of the ant hole in Phase 4. It matches a shot of a gaping mouth of Rock Hudson in seconds. It matches a commercial with a baby in it for Men and Baby Magic that he did. And so that was a typical Bass shot. What Hitchcock added was the blood going down the drain.
Somewhere the truth is somewhere in the middle, I get it.
That's right, that's right.
What a fascinating character Saul Bass is and was, and his brand continues, and the way he carved out quite the avant-garde niche in what was a fairly traditional Hollywood studio system. I really appreciate you, Chris, taking the time to speak with us today about Saul Bass.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
My guest today has been Jan Christopher Horak, director of the UCLA Film and Television Archive and author of the new book, Saul Bass, Anatomy of Film Design. The book is the first exhaustive profile and analysis of iconic graphic designer and filmmaker Saul Bass and is published by University Press of Kentucky. The book is available through all the usual online booksellers. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.